Welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers.
For those of you who are listening in your car or at home, I'm pleased to be recording in front of an audience here at the American Water Resources Association's annual conference in beautiful Key West. So before I introduce this top shelf group of conversation partners, yes, I wrote that, I'd like to offer my sincerest thanks to AWRA Florida, its board, and especially Luna Phillips, who agreed to do this very odd way of having one of your panels done, and so I appreciate that. As a shameless, not shameless plug, you're here, so if you aren't currently a member of AWRA, I highly recommend that you do it. It's a great organization. Also, I want to thank my sponsors. This podcast is a product of Florida Specifier Media, and it's made possible by the generosity of Resource Environmental Solutions, known as RES, and CN Shoreline. Thank you, boss. More on them later. Okay, with that healthy amount of ado and preamble to this whole thing, let's get to our guests. First, we have Kim Sugar. Kim is a senior advisor and environmental policy lead at the Aero Group, where she currently represents a wide array of clients on policy matters and government affairs. She has extensive public service background, including senior leadership roles at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, hold on to your hats, folks, the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, the Florida House of Representatives, the South Florida Water Management District, and if that wasn't enough, she also ran a nonprofit organization, which I've not talked to her about before, so I'm going to get some of that information in a little bit. Next, we have Adam Blaylock. Adam is the Deputy Secretary for Ecosystems Restoration at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, which oversees statewide water supply, the restoration and protection of Florida's aquatic ecosystems, including our state springs, rivers, estuaries, and the Everglades, manages aquatic research, monitoring, and analysis, and handles coastal protection and resiliency. And oh, by the way, he's been tasked with managing all the money, the grants and appropriations and loans for all of those things I just mentioned, so be very nice to him. He's an attorney by training, and my tenure at the Florida House of Representatives overlaps his, so you can trust me when I say that Florida is fortunate to have a dedicated, talented, and bright public servant. And last but certainly not least, we have Omar Franco with Becker and Polyakov. Omar heads Becker's federal lobbying practice in Washington, D.C. He currently represents a wide array of clients, including Fortune 500 companies, small businesses, higher education institutions, trade associations, nonprofit organizations, and municipal governments. He's a recognized leader in his field, and he's been named a top lobbyist by the National Institute of Lobbying and Ethics as recently as last year. And he's also a mainstay on The Hill's annual list of top lobbyists. All right, we're going to get to recent legislative activities, state and federal level, in a few minutes. But for those of you who've heard the podcast before, I know the folks that are listening at home have. I'm a big believer that motivations and experience are often just as important as expertise, although you guys are certainly experts at what you do. And so we're going to spend a little time on you individually, if you'll indulge me. Kim, let's start with you. Where are you from? How did you come to be such a fixture in the Florida environmental policy scene? And why did you end up taking your talents to the private sector with the Aero Group recently?
Thanks, Brett. Well, I'm a native Floridian. I've grown up in Orlando area. I'm similar to Mr. Spotswood. I grew up fishing with my dad. I didn't have the hat and gun, but by the time I was four, I did have my own fishing pole. So early on, I learned a lot of respect for our water resources, and it really is what my family believed in. And so my education is science-based. So like Brett, everybody asks, well, how did you get into the policy space? And that actually happened pretty early in my career. I was brought to a few meetings with some different agricultural stakeholders and some lawmakers, and I was asked to define what a TMDL was. And for whatever reason, everybody said, that's the first time we've ever understood that. So from that point on, I was invited to lots of meetings, appointed to different task force, and approached by several agencies to lead a variety of programs and offices and divisions that really were policy focused because of my ability to explain complicated science to a variety of different stakeholders. And then, so how did I get to the private sector, the Aero Group? So,
hang on, back up a second. He's like, let's go with the nonprofit. What nonprofit did you run and what did it do?
It was about Four to five years ago, I was running the American Membrane Technology Association. So it looked at a variety of technologies for treating water, specifically membranes. That was a great organization. There was just some things in life, so timing is everything. And so I ended up needing to transition into a different position and actually move back to the Department of Environmental Protection, working with Adam on water quality.
Doing what I consider, I'm going to call it the, just to, you know, be fair to the secretary, the second hardest job in state government, certainly related to the environment. No one's happy with your job. Once in a while, people are happy with Adam because he gives them money, but almost no one's happy with Kim. So I appreciate anyone who's willing to do that work. And so anyway, I interrupted. You're about to get to the Aero Group.
Oh, yes. Well, just kind of it, I guess, organically came about. I've been approached over time about moving into the private sector, and then it just, I guess, the time was right. And I love my time with government. Between the state and local government, I've worked for about 25 years. But I felt like there was more out there that I could really help clients. Working at state agencies, staff are great to work with. They work really hard, but we're limited on time. And also, we have to work within the confines of our agency. We all have laws and rules we have to work with. So sometimes you can't be as creative to help a stakeholder solve a problem. So in my role in the private sector, I have more time I can dedicate to clients, and I have the ability to go into other agencies. Like some of the stuff I'm working with clients now and trying to maybe see if we can bring into the environmental space is whether there are some different tax incentives that private companies can utilize to be able to contribute to water infrastructure. So those are things that, you know, working with agencies and within the government, you don't necessarily have time to really dig into. So I wanted to be able to bring my talents and time and help move water forward in the state.
Awesome. Adam, let's get to you next, sir. Talk about where you're from a little bit and in that path that took you all the way to Vermont before coming back to Florida to do what you're doing now.
Yeah, thank you. So kind of similar to Kim and Robert, I've lived in Florida pretty much my whole life, a little bit in Atlanta when I was really little, but spent a lot of that time, you know, taking advantage of Florida's waters and beaches, and was fortunate to have grandparents that had a house on Fernandina Beach, and spent all my summers kind of just doing the same thing, fishing and, you know, hiking, going through Fort Clinch and everything, just really garnered an appreciation for Florida's, you know, water bodies and just the unique ecosystem that a lot of us enjoy. And so was interested in doing, at one time I thought I was going to be like a marine biologist or whatnot, and then as I was looking at a majors for college, realized all of them took advanced calculus, which I was not going to take advanced calculus in the college. I knew where to draw the line, but I still was just really interested in the subject area, and so I went to UF and did political science, and as I was taking those courses, I took a lot of environmental law, environmental policy classes, and then pretty much all of my non-core classes, I was doing, you know, environmental science, forestry, just kind of being able to still get a lot of the involvement in those topics. And so once I graduated and didn't really know what I wanted to do with a political science degree, my dad said, why don't you go to law school? And I was like, you know, I was really interested in a lot of the environmental laws and everything. And so started researching, you know, what are the top environmental law schools in the country. And at that time, Vermont Law School was one of the best and had a really prolific course offering. And so he was like, well, I've never been to New England before. That sounds fun. And went to law school up in Vermont and really enjoyed it. But also three Vermont winters was all I could muster. And so came back and knew I wanted to come back to Florida. And so it was just fortunate I got hired right out of law school to work for the House of Representatives on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee. And what I thought might just be kind of a couple years to get some experience, and turned into 10. And then from there, did a stint in private practice with Hopping Green and Sam's in Tallahassee. And then about a little over 5 years ago, was approached about taking this position. And I'd have to say my current job's definitely one of the most enjoyable, just getting to work on such a wide variety of issues and with all the funding. And yeah, there's a period of a year where I'm everybody's best friend, and then there's a few weeks where about half of people's best friends, the other half, you know, but then the grant portal opens again and everybody's happy again. So, but yeah, so that's kind of my journey. It's been just kind of one of, you know, I think good luck. I've been able to work with some really good people and just kind of has fallen together. So thank you.
And last, and again, not least, Omar. Omar, I think you have the most, if it's possible, because this is a pair here next to you that have tons of experience, but I think you have the most wide-ranging experience of the group, myself included. So walk us through the path that started in Florida, but then led you to be one of the most effective lobbyists in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
We'll start with
simple. Born and raised in Miami, you know, went to Columbus High, Miami-Dade College, Florida State. Like you, Adam, I figured out quickly I wasn't going to do advanced calculus, but I did do business in English, which made me perfect for a campaign manager position because I could balance a checkbook and write copy at the sixth grade level. It's a very rare skill set. So I did possess those. George Dominicis, for those of you who remember, George helped me get into the business, worked on campaigns, was still in the private sector. I was an accountant for a while, so really understood the business side of things. Politics was kind of like a side hobby. But then Art Simon, if you all remember Art Simon, that was a while ago. Yes, I was a Democrat. I'm a reformed Democrat, but I was a Democrat. I work with Art Simon, but he was a brilliant lawmaker, one of the best ever to step foot in the Florida legislature. And that really set my path. Like, you know, because in this business, you need mentors and people to really guide you. I worked for Annie Betancourt, which she was in the South Florida Water Management District. So she was great to work with, and that's really when I started really getting involved in what I call water world and everything, you know, having to deal with water. Then I made the transition. It's like switching religion. You can only do it once, because if you do it twice, it's bad. So I became a Republican around 96 when then State Senator Mario Diaz-Balart asked me to come over as his legislative assistant. And, you know, Mario just, you know, it was great working with him, being an insurance chair. So we did a lot with Bill Nelson at the time. Just great. We became just really good friends. And then my lobbying career is actually...
Let me interrupt just because I want to set on that issue a bit, because it seems like, and this is, you know, this is me, it's like it seems it's less typical. I would say somewhere between less typical and rare. So go from, as you say, switching religion, switching parties. Like you work for Democrats. The big switch, and I think some of it revolved around the 1992 reapportionment back in those days, where it seemed to be a reshuffling. Was it easier to deal with that shuffling in the late 90s more so than, say, could someone get away with it now at the... especially at the federal level?
No, that's a great question. You know, I don't think they could get away with it now. I mean, I think Mario was very forward-thinking. He looked at me as the best person for the job, regardless. He actually loved, because back then, remember, we were going in the late 80s from 90 to 30 Democrats in control. Same thing we have now with the Republicans. Mm-hmm. It was just reversed. So in the mid-90s, that's when, you know, the Reagan Revolution, that's when a lot of things, anti-Clinton sentiment, a lot of things started happening. Cubans started getting elected, especially in South Florida, to a high degree, and they were all Republicans. So I think that kind of, so it was an easy transition for me, but I really do give Mario a lot of credit for just, you know, kind of viewing in me someone who knew the process of getting bills passed and bills funded. So he thought that was more important, and my party affiliation was kind of an aside at the time. Again, you know, sadly, I don't know if that would happen right now, Brett. You know, I really just don't. But yeah, going back to me, my lobbying career started Edgar Fernandez, so blame Edgar when you see him. He was leaving the Florida Medical Association. He said, hey, dude, you know, are you ready to do something new? I'm like, yes, I'm ready for the dark side. Just let's go. And so started off with the Florida Medical Association, went over to University of Miami.
What year was that when you went to the... 98. Okay.
98. And then around 2000, I went to University of Miami, started at the medical school. But then when Shalala got there, President Shalala, she promoted me, gave me state and federal lobbyists for the entire university. So, but then, you know, life has a way of, you know, laughing at you when you make plans. You know, I had just bought a house. I had just had twins. and just the perfect time for me to run a campaign for him to win a congressional seat, and then he turns around and asks me to be his chief of staff. So that was 03. And listen, if you ever get the chance to be a chief of staff, take it. It is awesome. It is like the best job you can possibly have, because you get kind of a lot of the power that the politician or your boss has. But so you can do the politics, and then you can do the policy as well. It is so, it was so much fun. I would still be there, but again, I had twins, so there was that. But I stayed with him for 5 years, and then, you know, I've just been lobbying for a lot of Florida. I moved up there 22 years now, and have just been, you know, the great thing is, since I had such a deep background in Florida politics and in Florida, so many Florida entities, they just viewed me as a friend and as a liaison, someone that you didn't have to explain to me the Everglades or, you know, the reservoir or anything. I'm a Floridian. I know it, right? And having an actual Floridian in D.C., it just took the science of you all having to explain to me all the nuances, right? I grew up here. I knew them by heart. So that's why I've been representing a lot of local governments now. We represent, you know, Disney, iHeart, Paramount, you know, just a ton, great clients, you know, a lot. CN Shoreline, obviously, one of our favorites. But yeah, no, we love being your kind of like your eyes and ears in Washington. Washington is a really crappy place if you let it be, because, you know, the politics are just so much big, so big, and you know, the rhetoric gets so crazy that you kind of need someone, you know, to really help navigate you through that.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at CN Shoreline. Since its inception in 2014, CN Shoreline's unmatched experience with scientifically validated methods of aquatic restoration has proven successful across more than 150 environmental projects. The company continues to be the industry leader in rehabilitating threatened and corrupted aquatic environments with proven success in places such as Crystal River, Homosassa River, the Caloosahatchee River, and the Indian River Lagoon. I've seen firsthand how CN Shoreline completely reset the ecosystem in Crystal River, transforming from a mucky, algae-dominated system to one with plants that actually belong there. The water used to be full of Lingbia and Hydrilla, with a thick bottom layer of muck that smelled like rotten eggs. But with CN Shoreline's comprehensive muck removal and planting of native eelgrasses, the system is now beautiful, crystal clear, with lush eelgrass meadows. The manatees are feasting, fish have returned, ecotourism is booming, and property values have significantly increased. CN Shoreline is committed to restoring and preserving Florida's communities and aquatic ecosystems because they're Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with CN Shoreline to help your community, visit them at www.cnshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, back to the conversation.
And we're going to get to some of that in a little while, because we're going to talk about some issues at the state level, but I think that also have huge impacts on your clients, being whether they're thinking, you know, federal or state. These are issues that are there. Are you still kind of firmly you live in D.C.? Like, but are you how much time and effort and attention, you know, has to be given back into Florida?
Yeah, no, I was just Miami-Dade with Paramount. For those of you who watch Dexter Origins is going to hopefully be filmed in Miami now. So you know, that's one of the projects I'm working on. Eastern Shipbuilding Group. I was just in Panama City. We represent them, you know, the only Coast Guard shipbuilder in the state of Florida. So again, you know, I'm here at least once a month, if not more. And if not, you all are visiting me up there, because it's kind of, the Capitol is a cool place to visit. And by the way, we can get you really good tours. So if you guys are interested.
Indeed, we are interested, sir. Thank you for that. All right, let's get into the you know, meat of the conversation when it comes to Florida. And let's start in Florida. We'll, you know, obviously there's a lot of tie-ins, but we'll get to some of that in a bit. But Kim, let me ask you to take the first shot at talking about how the budget shaped up this year. The session itself was a bit of an interesting time. We didn't finish on time, but we didn't finish after the July 1st, so I guess that's a success. The Water Quality Improvement Grant funding stands out, I think, among that, and cover as much as you want, but that stands out in my mind as one of those budget items that's created probably the most complicated downstream effects. And yes, if you hear me say a pun like that, they're always intended.
Well, the FY25 budget is $117 billion, and that was after about $600 million worth of vetoes. So you definitely saw during session there were definitely different philosophies from our leadership in the legislature as well as the governor's office of how we should approach funding in the state. Now, there are some areas that they all had agreement on, like they believed in debt reduction, tax relief to families and businesses, building reserves. Infrastructure is considered very important, as well as resilience, and not even the resilience that we're talking about here today for water and the environment, but just broadly. So some aspects of the environmental budget did very well, received funding, the similar funding for SERP, a little bit more for Resilient Florida, but then there were definitely some other areas that didn't receive as much funding this year. And while some of the smaller grant programs like Biscayne Bay and the Florida Keys, they did receive funding, but there was the large Water Quality Improvement Fund that didn't receive funding this year. The philosophy from the legislature was that they wanted to fund specific projects. So what did pass was very individualized. And this wasn't just for water, even though the environmental budget was definitely one of the most, I don't know if I want to say controversial, but there were definitely different opinions by leadership of how that should be handled. But you also saw it for road projects and as well as other infrastructure in the state.
Do you mind? I know it probably still stings a little bit. We're only in August, and so we're still kind of dealing with what's going on. Can you talk a little bit about what happened and then what the status of that the grant program, the other grant programs, because the portal is open at the moment, right, for people to put in applications for various and sundry projects. Talk about what that means for the portal, you know, in terms of what communities are able to do, communities' abilities to meet obligations as it relates to water quality. Can you just kind of help hash through that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, I think, a surprise when all of the water quality improvement grant funding got earmarked for individual water projects, particularly a lot of probably half of the projects that were funded really weren't water quality projects at all. But be that as it may, you know, we still did get significant funding from the legislature. So I don't want to say that, you know, they did nothing for water quality in the state. We got a lot of funding for, you know, our TMDL money, for resilience, for Indian River Lagoon, Biscayne Bay, and the Keys, and our Springs restoration funding. So definitely, you know, got significant funding. And as Kim mentioned, we got, you know, $830 million for Everglades-related projects and roughly about $550 million for SERP alone. So, you know, there is, you know, a lot of money out there, but I think a lot of the local governments were also kind of caught off guard because, you know, they are relying quite a bit on the state helping to offset some of the costs of meeting their water quality needs. Septic sewer projects, going to advanced waste treatment, stormwater upgrades, all of those things are projects that need to be done to see improvement in our water resources. And the state over the last, you know, 6 years had significant amount of money going to help offset some of those costs. And so we had multi-year projects for local governments to be able to, you know, spread out the funding availability across multiple years. And so some who had gotten, you know, a couple years of funding kind of relying on that next tranche to complete their projects were kind of left in a little bit of a lurch. And so, you know, we've really been able to fund a lot of really good projects, saw a lot of, you know, nutrient reduction through those projects. And I think, you know, the hope is that as we go into next session, we can go back to that kind of balanced approach of funding, you know, specific member projects, particularly ones that are equally important, but maybe not highly qualified or eligible for the Water Quality Improvement Grant, but things that are more like aging infrastructure upgrades, doing projects to try to reduce SSOs and things like that that typically wouldn't be a highly scored project for the Water Quality Improvement Grant.
From a logistical standpoint, one would think that not having to deal with $400 million, you know, in water quality improvement grants makes your life easier. But it sounds to me, or seems to me, that probably makes your life harder, because now you're figuring out not just how to reschedule what people were doing over a multi-year basis, but also a lot more attention is probably, my guess is more attention is being paid and effort being put into the IRL Springs, other places where you do have, you know, funding that remains. Does that put, how much pressure does that put on the department to try to shoehorn as many projects as possible into these other places, you know, where there are dollars?
Yeah, that's what we'll do. I mean, the portal will close September 1st. We'll start evaluating all the projects, and, you know, most of the pots are for specific water bodies, so it will be looking at, you know, the same kind of criteria we would do for the water quality improvement grant, where the, you know, shovel ready, best nutrient reduction costs, and just trying to see what projects are going to create the biggest, you know, impact for water quality. And we've seen, so we had got about a little over 800 million for the clean water SRF program, which is not, you know, a grant. So most people, you know, prefer the grants over the loans, but this particular amount of money is zero interest. And it also did allow for full principal forgiveness, depending on if you are economically disadvantaged community, but up to 50% cost share. And so we saw about $4 billion worth of projects submitted for that $800 million, which in the past, you know, there wouldn't be quite as much. So it just shows that even without the water quality improvement grant, there's still significant needs, and local governments want to, and not just local governments, but they're, you know, the primary when you're talking about septic sewer and, you know, advanced waste treatment upgrades and things like that. They want to continue doing these projects because it's important to them. They need to do it, meet their allocations if they're in areas where there's basin management action plan and things like that. So, you know, the projects are still there, still going forward. And so I think we'll just kind of see as the, you know, next session goes on, kind of getting back into, like I said, having some of that complete, having a little bit more for the wastewater water quality improvement grant to help kind of subsidize some of those projects.
And Kim, in your masochistic chapter of your career as a director of DEER, you were part of creating the latest BMAPs, those Basin Management Action Plans. You have a number of local government clients. What are you telling them about what to do in these circumstances in your current role?
First one will sound kind of funny, but I've told them they really need to read the BMAPs. From my experience working at the department, a lot of folks, they might read a little area, think that's all that applies to them, but they haven't looked at the big picture and taken consideration everything that they may need to do. So that's the first step. Second, I've encouraged them to complete different planning areas, and really areas that involve all water resources, because as we know, water quality, flooding, water supply, they're all tied together, resilience. So there's a couple that I'm working with that haven't finished their vulnerability assessment. So I said, you need to do that, because some of your water quality improvement, like one of my know needs to move their wastewater facility because it floods. So it could become eligible for resilience funding but they need to do the steps. So, you know, follow through, complete your steps. I'm also encourage them to look for partnerships. Sometimes a regional facility may be more cost-effective than an individual facility. So look, see what other partners are out there. Try to identify different approaches to accomplish what you need to accomplish. And then the last is go after whatever funding exists. And while that seems kind of funny to say, but I do have some local governments and even some private clients that are concerned about federal funding. They're like, well, there's extra requirements. You need to do this or that. But as we saw with the water quality improvement grant, you don't know if a funding source is going to be there. So you need to take advantage of whatever you possibly can while it's there. And if something else comes up in the future, of course, you can shift course.
Yeah, on that note, Adam, and this is a conversation that you and I had, I think, kind of almost in passing. It's probably like 3-4 weeks ago, I want to say. And we were talking about what, you know, the aftermath of post-no water quality improvement grant program. And you said something that kind of stood out. I think a lot of people see this as maybe this broader state activity that's going on, whether it's the meeting the TMDL, complying with, you know, the BMAPs and reaching those targets. But you said something that I think maybe is good for people to hear, which is regardless of what happens. So if you don't have $400 million or $200 million or $1.5 billion in the end, you said people who have the responsibility within BMAPs are responsible for meeting those outcomes. Can you talk about, repeating what I just said is like, or maybe it's like you can, you know, say it more artfully than I just did, but it kind of, that's the deal, right?
Yeah. I mean, once the BMAP gets, you know, effective, you know, we've kind of laid out this project process, and over, you know, in 1379, a lot of the, I guess, criticism of the BMAPs was, you know, they aren't enforceable. You can't really go and make anybody do anything until, you know, the 20-year window is up. And a lot of that was kind of true. And so we required, you know, 5-year milestones. So each entity that gets a specific allocation that they have to reduce their nutrient loading by has to meet 5, 10, 15, and 20-year milestones. They don't necessarily have to meet your 5 and then meet your 10. You could say, I'm going to do, you know, this large regional project, it'll get me to 10, and then, you know, you don't have to complete that by the 5-year, but you are, whether there's $1 billion or $0, each of the entities that have a specific load reduction requirement, they have to meet that or they would be subject to enforcement. But we did, in the Water Quality Improvement Grant, I mean, we did kind of have a, I guess, method to the madness of saying, like, you know, the remediation, septic and wastewater remediation plans and projects to implement a BMAP, all of those were specifically outlined as being eligible for Water Quality Improvement Grant, because we do. I mean, there's no doubt of recognition that these projects and the amount of nutrient reduction required in a lot of the BMAPs are going to take significant investment, and a lot of local governments, particularly the smaller or more rural, that really don't have the even the rate base to pay for it, let alone just, you know, the funds. And even the larger, you know, cities and counties and the more wealthy, there's still hundreds of millions of dollars to achieve the required reductions. And so having that kind of grant program to the scale that it has been in the past was able to at least take away some of that burden, at least the initial, as they look to plan, you know, their future expenditures.
Let me shift that conversation to you, Omar, on the federal side. It's almost like squeezing a balloon. You know, if the federal government doesn't pay for something, then the states have to do it. If the states don't do it, local government has to do it. If either one does it, they go back to the federal government and ask them for money. Is that what's happening in these moments? Do you see some of that related to funding issues with your local government clients?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, so what happens is if the state doesn't fund it, you know, you go through your earmark process at the state level, and if you don't get funded there, it doesn't look like it's going to go through. The first thing we do, we turn around, septic to sewer projects, right? We'll go straight to the federal government. What's happened this year, it's been, you know, unique, right? Because, you know, with President Trump coming in, the whole DOGE, and I know we'll talk about that later, a lot of the federal governments for at least 130 days were on pause, right? They weren't releasing anything. I mean, a lot of these folks that we were talking to didn't know if they were even going to stick around, because a lot of them decided to take that package. So really, you know, that's what we, there wasn't a place to send them to, especially as the state was kind of wrapping up. So now that DOGE is kind of at least the 130 days of Elon, and that is gone, they're gone now. Now we're moving into the secretaries have now assumed that control, and they can still do DOGE, but I think now the appetite is, hey, we have until September 30th, let's start pushing money out the door, right? Mm-hmm. So now with everything that was there, and remember, we're still dealing with FY24 dollars, because since the FY25 bill went down the toilet, like it's gone. So they were never able to really refresh from all the way to, you know, what they call the Pelosi budget, right? So there's still a lot of pent-up frustration about having to deal with those numbers where they want to start doing it internally. So you're going to start seeing it. EPA, you're going to, all the Department of Interior grants, you're going to start it seeing come out, and it's going to start coming out fast and furious. So, you know, I'm telling my local governments, we're going to keep them apprised of everything that's coming out. But like to Kim's point, don't leave money on the table. Go for it.
Explain on that, and we'll skip, you know, let's just skip forward to it. It's like, talk about what WERDA is, not just for people in the room. I think most people in this room know what it is. But folks that may be listening out there, what is it? Because it's been so inconsistent, it's like, what is to be counted on in the midst of all of that? Kind of, how do you explain it to people?
You know, it's, you know, basically Water Resources Development Act. I mean, when WERDA comes down, it's any water project, at least for the next 2 years, has to be authorized. It's a license to hunt. Because if you don't get it authorized in WERDA, then you can't go to the Appropriations Committee to get it actually appropriated and get the dollars. So that's why the WERDA process, especially for Florida, is huge. Luckily, on the T&I committee, we have both Dan Webster, we have Brian Mast. So they are very familiar, and they have a ton of projects, and they work with the state of Florida very closely and with the Army Corps, right, to get those projects funded. So we do have a late addition. Jimmy Petronas is now going to be joining the T&I committee. So we're obviously very excited to have him on board. And Frederica Wilson is a Democrat in Miami, and she's been extremely helpful. So we have a good core of transportation and, you know, folks in the transportation committee. And again, you know, Mario Diaz-Balart and Debbie Wasserman Schultz also are like the top two appropriators for the state, but they are exceedingly powerful right now, both on the majority side and the minority side. Mario Diaz-Balart is vice chair of the appropriations, but he sits on defense, T-HUD, and he chairs the state foreign ops committee. So because of his perch, he's the dean of the delegation, so we all rely on him, especially on everything Everglades, right? So he's the one who carries most of the water for us because of his position. So I just wanted to let you know, like, look, whatever issues you'll have, you know, bubble it up to the congressman, but get it to Mr. Diaz-Balart's office. And, you know, the senators now, with Rubio, Rick Scott has ascended now to being the senior senator, and he's great on all these issues. He's actually fantastic, has great staff. Ashley Moody is doing a great job. She has a fantastic new chief of staff, Justin Roth. I would highly suggest getting hold of their office as well. They're totally, you know, committed to getting the most dollars for Florida as well.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.com. All right, now back to the conversation.
Let's move to something that sometimes goes well and sometimes doesn't. But for the moment, I'm going to let you two, I'm looking at Kim and Adam here to explain to me how it's, we're in a good moment. And I'm talking about the Everglades. And so kind of two things there, if y'all don't mind. First, our keynote speaker today, Mr. Spotswood from the South Florida Water Management District, talked about a lot of things that have happened. I'm curious to know, one is, how much closer are we to the goal for Everglades restoration? And two, how does the memorandum of understanding that was signed by the governor in Marco Island a few weeks ago, how does that fit into that picture?
Yeah, I can go first. You know, the MOU definitely was a driver to express the need and the want to expedite Everglades restoration, particularly with the AA Reservoir, and we saw that commitment to seek to speed that construction up to 2029. And then alongside that, it really the kind of primary purpose of it was to memorialize existing authorities that are in federal law that would allow a state to come in as a state sponsor to take over a federal authorized project. And there's existing authorities to do that, but this really kind of directed both the state and the Army Corps to go down and start going down that path and do it in a way that's more efficient, less bureaucracy. And that's kind of where we are now, is kind of putting together that initial framework of how will we kind of, what will be the steps to, you know, achieve that. And it did say that we're gonna start that process with Blue Chaney Flowway, which when you talk about the EA Reservoir and moving water south, you know, you get the Tamiami road raising completed, the reservoir completed, but Blue Chaney really allows, without that component completed as well, being able to move as much water that we want to move in a way that doesn't cause adverse environmental impacts, flooding impacts, and it's always been one that's been very, knowing it's been going to be very important, and the state had already taken over just this past year one of the pump stations because it was getting delayed at the federal level, and we needed that because without that, the rest of it couldn't be done. And so it made sense to be the first one, but it will take congressional funding on top of what the Congress appropriates for the Corps to do their Everglades. So that'll be something as we start looking, and that's part of kind of the conversations now with the ASA's office and the state, is how we kind of can set that funding, because one of the main benefits of the state is we don't need the entire amount of the project funded up front. So when it's a core project, if it's a $500 million project, they have to get $500 million appropriated. We can do, if it's $500 million over, you know, 10 years or whatever, if we just need whatever is necessary for each year going forward. So that does allow the federal government to fund projects not necessarily needing so much up front, which is, you know, something that would help on a budgetary standpoint. But, you know, a lot of projects, I mean, Robert said, you know, 76 projects that over the last 6 years. So, I mean, there really has been some significant improvements on Everglades restoration. And I think that'll just keep continue. And this just adds one other kind of tool to be able to kind of keep things on track and continue that working relationship with the Corps and the state. So.
Seems like money's, you know, I mean, it's almost always the issue for almost every single thing that anyone does ever. But when it comes to the Everglades, I mean, the Everglades did pretty well this past session. I think one of y'all covered the amount earlier. But that's the trick, though, right? On the federal funding side, is like we can, you know, you can budget $600, $800, $1 billion, you know, here in Florida, but you've got to get the help from the other end, right?
But yeah. Let me tell you, if it wasn't for the state really making that investment, I got to tell you, it would be almost extreme. It would be impossible to get the federal funding. So when the state really put in that heavy commitment, it allows us to leverage it. Because trust me, whoever the Interior Appropriations Chair is on any given year, they're not from Florida. They want that money back to put into their project. And in that pod specifically, I want to say Everglades restoration on any given year makes up 50 to 75% of the entire pot for the entire country. Mm-hmm. So every single congressman, you know, going back to Charles Taylor from Mississippi, they hate the Everglades. So they want to see it. They think it's a boondoggle. They don't understand it. It's just so hard to explain. Can I tell one story?
Yes.
One story. All right.
If it's like
one
that,
story.
Yes.
Charles Taylor put in language in the Interior Appropriations Bill that said...
Who's Charles Taylor?
He was the chair of the Interior Appropriations Committee at the time. And he goes, in the bill language, so it would be law, that in order for Everglades restoration dollars to keep flowing, five federal agencies would have to agree and sign off for the money to flow. Five federal agencies couldn't agree that the sky is blue, much less, you know, that Everglades funding was needed. So what we had to do is that we had to go in there and do like a Jedi mind trick and go, no, this is, you know, we had to go, no, funding will continue to flow unless five federal agencies, you know, name them, it's the ones you know of, would. And by the way, Lincoln Diaz-Balart, at the time, who was on rules with Alcee Hastings, had to stop it cold in the Rules Committee, much to Mr. Taylor's chagrin. And he gave us 24 hours. The Speaker had to come down and give us 24 hours to fix this, or else it was going to become law. So we got the language. Thank God Taylor caved, because he didn't know that he had the 24 hours, because if the 24 hours had passed, it would have been law. And, you know, that would have basically cut it loose. So, you know, I say these things because it's been such a huge struggle. Every single dollar that we get from the federal government has been a huge struggle. But to your point, you know, that the state has been so deeply committed has been huge, because we can leverage that and we can point, like, look, this is a true partnership. And we're all in this together. And if you all weren't doing that, then no way could Mario and Debbie and Lois and all our appropriators fight for those dollars.
But let me ask that question. I mean, it's more of the end. It's like, I think maybe philosophically it may be, it sounds like it looks to be with the kind of money that goes to something every single year, that it's just that there's the Everglades as a federal agency or a state agency where it gets money every year.
It comes at a cost. It comes at a political cost, right? Because most of our delegation puts so much time and effort into that, and many of them make it the line in the sand. Like, this is, like, we won't vote for these bills unless this is included.
My question is, and probably better, you know, for Kim, you've been on the business end of this in the past, or maybe, you know, either one of you, you or Adam, where is the end a dollar amount to fund remaining projects for SERP, or is the end amount, like, we know we're going to do it in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? Like, what are these legislators, and when they go to fight for this every year, say, other than, gosh, we got to do this because that's what we do. We do Everglades restoration.
Yeah, I mean, I think recently, I don't know if it was Congress or an agency came at federal, like, estimate for completing SERP, and I don't want to say, but I felt like it was maybe $13, $14 billion to complete that, and, you know, but we've spent so much and achieved so much, and we are seeing the ecological response. But it also, even when all these projects are completed, I mean, the Water Management District knows the O&M, you know, it's not like you can just let it keep going there, like, status quo. You know, there's going to be continued STA improvements and maintenance and different things like that. But it all is, you know, I think when you look at the economic benefit that Everglades restoration provides, you know, it's much greater than the cost to do it. Same with, you know, all of the water quality, you know, projects. When you look at the lost revenues from the algal blooms, you know, that's so much more than what it's costing to do the things to prevent that from happening. So, and I think all the even Republicans and Democrats realize that, and that's why you always get across the board support over, you know, the last, you know, even since DeSantis really came in with that strong push for environmental restoration, that it is something that everybody in the state supports because they know the economic benefit and tourism, and Florida relies on tourists, a growth state. We don't have income tax. So this, if you don't have this as a revenue source, then, you know, that's going to be even a greater hit to the budget than spending it on these projects.
Let's shift farther north to the Indian River Lagoon, Adam. What's the latest? It's been severely impaired. There are plenty of news stories in recent years about impacts there. What's the latest progress on the health of that system?
I think when you look at the lagoon, you know, as a whole, there's definitely areas where we are seeing really good improvements. There are some areas more in the northern lagoon where there's still struggles with algal blooms and things that create the dissipation of seagrasses. But I think the Water Management St. John's and their latest seagrass coverage has seen pretty significant increases in seagrass coverage in parts of the Indian River Lagoon. And so, you know, we know that septic tanks are a massive issue in the lagoon, and we know that if you remove those and do advanced waste treatment, address stormwater, that these projects work. It's going to reduce nutrients, reduce algal blooms, reduce the seagrass loss and the habitat, you know, that the relies on that. And we are seeing, I mean, when you look at the trend analysis and aspects where there have been a lot of this investment in, you know, Brevard County, they've really taken advantage of the grant program, and we've been able to fund some really significant regional wastewater projects along with, you know, Indian River County, Martin County, and we are seeing the water quality improvement. But it is, you know, you get a dry year and then a wet year with a ton of runoff, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're going to have blips. I think that's one of the things, you know, when they say we want to see improvement. It's never going to be, you know, water quality improving in a straight line. It's, you know, going to go kind of like the stock market, but you do want to see that gradual decline.
Sure.
But, I mean, there's a relatively small fish kill in the IRL a couple weeks ago from low DO that, because they had some uptick in algal bloom conditions. So, you know, you're still going to have that, but it is just if we keep funding the projects and working with the local governments to reduce the nutrients, you will see the improvement. And, you know, we are seeing it. It takes a lot of time. It took a lot of time to create the current situation, and it's going to take equal or probably amount of time to,
you know, to that extent, Kim, you represent at least a couple local governments on the lagoon. What is their perspective on that? Is like, did they see the progress? Do they understand the value of doing the things that are related to not just the restoration side, but the, you know, the source input side?
Yeah, I mean, from the stakeholders and local governments, you know, there's, I guess, the big mixed bag of feelings. One, they've been really grateful and appreciative of all the grant funding that's been coming. So they are seeing those capital projects. So that has been really helpful moving forward. And as Adam mentioned, there are the ecological improvements that they've been seeing. On the other side, though, there's a lot of apprehension as to whether they can actually meet all the requirements in the BMAP. And really some of the specific areas of concern lie where where you have to do a lot of work with individual homeowners. So some of the septic to sewer projects, especially if the septic tanks are more spread out, they're concerned to how they're going to be able to get those individuals to phase off. And then the other biggest challenge is the portion of stormwater that really deals with individual homeowners' lawns. It's very hard to get people to change their practice. There isn't, you know, homeowners don't see the immediate change. Like, if I don't fertilize here, I won't have a fish kill. And it's very hard to have those conversations. And so local governments, not just the ones on the lagoon, but really statewide, that is a big challenge to figure out how they're going to accomplish, you know, that more difficult increment.
Yeah, I think that those policies that are needed to meet, you know, the load reductions and water quality, but when they are cost directly to a homeowner versus, you know, a utility, you know, they are hard for local governments to tell, you know, their constituents, like, you got to remove the septic tank that's going to cost you, you know, $20,000. So, I mean, I think that is really what the benefit of the grant program is for those specific situations. And then, yeah, the education, I think, the green grass right on the lagoon. I mean, it's definitely, if we could reduce some of the, you know, amount of fertilizer, and that's why we kind of did the legislation to, you know, try to where you have reclaimed water. You know, most people don't realize that you don't really need to even put any fertilizer because there's nutrients in there, but that's, you know, there's a lot of education that could be done to try to just curb some of the nutrient loading that does occur into the lagoon specifically. So.
All right. Appreciate that. That was good. Luna, how are we on time? I'm ready for a lightning round here. Is that okay? And so we have questions I typically ask guests, and in the interest of time, I'm going to alternate these back and forth. And so, Omar, you get the first one. What professional accomplishment are you most proud of?
Stopping Charles Taylor's interior appropriations language, you know, and doing the Jedi mind trick. Listen, we get anywhere between, I don't know, $80 to $100 million federal dollars to our local communities every year. We represent about 30 to 40 municipalities. We represent the Florida League of Cities. We represent Florida Rural Economic Development Association. So it's just, you know, just getting those dollars. And it's every single year. It's not one particular year. And some of these are big, big dollar amounts, right, you know, especially for Everglades restoration. And you know, it's a team effort, obviously. It requires, you know, a lot of folks. But But you gotta get, you know, you gotta get representation. You gotta get up there, and you gotta be the squeaky wheel, right? That's the only way it gets done. So we're only as good as you guys coming to us and giving us the information that we need to get up there. So that's what I would say. I mean, you know, appropriations is where it's at, and you know, keep fighting every year for that.
Adam, you get the next two. Congratulations. Are you optimistic about the future of the environment and natural systems in Florida?
I mean, I don't think I could say no.
That was the easy one.
Yeah, I am. I mean, we know what needs to be done. I mean, the data and the science that we collect, and, you know, we, particularly when it comes to like the nutrient issue in our water bodies, and with the continued, you know, support from the governor and legislature to provide the funding to help offset some of these costs so that we can really continue to see the improvements. You know, I think we're in, you know, a really good space over the last couple of years with legislation to really try to tighten the ability to uphold and implement a lot of our water quality programs, and then with the funding, and we're getting, you know, and a lot of the local governments are looking and being like, this does benefit me, even though there is a big cost, and we're seeing a lot of support from, you know, the various stakeholders. So
despite the optimism, is there something that keeps you up at night in terms of the environment in Florida?
I mean, probably just the fact that even though we are, you know, doing a lot, that you can turn on the news one morning and see, you know, a million fish dead or an algal bloom, you know, impacting a large water body like, you know, Lake Okeechobee or the estuaries like we saw in 2018, 2017. So I think that's mostly it, just knowing that, you know, you're doing all this work to try to prevent that, but, you know, it's still inevitable that you're going to have those kind of situations until, you know, there's really, you know, you've met all your water quality standards. So I think that's mostly it, just trying to, you never want to see that, you know, happen. I think like with the manatee mortality and just things like that, that, you know, are going to happen from time to time. But, you know, I think that's still something that, yeah, keeps me up a little bit.
And Kim, what advice would you give young people who are entering or thinking about getting into the water environmental field? And that could be NGO, private sector, or government, because you've done them all.
Well, I would say that it's an exciting opportunity. There's a lot that you can do. But as you come into it, you should probably come into it with persistence and patience in mind. A lot of the efforts that we work on are long-term. And so you want to pace yourself. So I always want to say approach it like a marathon and not a sprint. And I know that can be really frustrating for people, but it's really important so that you don't lead yourself to burnout or complete frustration, because your efforts are really important. They are helpful. Second, for a new person, I say definitely network, find some mentors, and not even in mentors in the areas you might think, like if you want to go in policy, I would find a couple in different areas, because like I said, I started strong science. I thought I was going to teach and be in the field all the time. And then other things come up. So you never know what you might be interested in until you experience it. And along with that, find some additional skills, whether it's communication or you want to learn about the law or GIS, just something else, because that opens up a lot of doors into maybe some areas you hadn't thought about initially.
Very well said. And a great place to end, I think, whether we like it or not anyway. Kim Sugar, Adam Blaylock, Omar Franco, thank you so much for doing the show. And thanks to AWRA Florida, Luna Phillips, the board, and also for Monroe County for agreeing to and supporting this unusual format. Thanks, y'all.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. And thank you once again to Rez and CN Shoreline for making it possible. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod, and you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.